Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We are your hosts, Matt Levine.
And Vincent Hannum.
And we are talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between, all strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com, hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, stay campy, everybody. Camp Kaiju also says, sometimes in order to experience death, you have to F a gallbladder. Is that the quote? That's maybe more of a paraphrase, but tonight we are talking about Flesh for Frankenstein, in which Udo Kier, as Baron Frankenstein, speaks that immortal line. So welcome to the episode, and welcome back, Frank.
Yay, Frank.
Not the most family-friendly episode for not the most family-friendly movie, I guess.
Well, I'm not going to like start swearing right off the bat. I'm going to censor myself at least initially, but probably not going to last. Yeah.
That line is so wickedly over the top. It deserves the full Monty. So sometime by the end of the episode, Matt, just let it rip.
Nice. I definitely will, unless Frank wants to. I know Frank loves that line, too.
Well, I have to tell you, too, so while I was watching this movie the other night, I actually rewound that part and, like, got my phone out to, like, video it and then texted it to my brother to make him laugh because I knew he'd think that was really funny. So, and there were a couple other lines of dialogue, too, which I guess we can get into later, which I did the same thing for, actually. I did that, like, 3 or 4 times during this movie, so...
Frank, what did your brother, has he seen this movie? I know he's a big horror fan.
I don't think he has, surprisingly. I actually had asked him last time I saw him if he had a copy of the movie, but he did not, which surprised me a little bit because I saw, the companion film to this one. Now I'm blanking on the name. Is it Blood for Dracula?
Yeah.
I watched that one with him years and years ago and remember not really liking it. But I just figured since, that he would have seen this one too, but apparently not. Apparently, he has not seen this one somehow, even though he's a huge horror aficionado.
I would imagine that he'll be, amused by it, to say the least. I have not seen Blood for Dracula, but, you know, if it's anything like this movie, I really do want to watch it soon. I've heard that it's not, not as good as Flesh for Frankenstein, but... Not as good might be a kind of a relative phrase in this case.
Right. What I've heard is that it maybe takes itself more seriously. That's one person's take. I haven't seen Blood for Dracula. I have heard there is humor in Flesh for Frankenstein. I see that what people talk about, the aforementioned line, for example. But we'll get into it later, but I feel like the humor was a bit lost on me. Maybe not my type.
Yeah, no, that's certainly understandable. I feel like any range of reactions to this movie from just like completely hating it and thinking it's the worst piece of trash ever made to like loving it and like watching it constantly and being totally delighted by it. All like both of those reactions totally make sense to me in this case. Which is great. I mean, I love a movie that can elicit such a wide response.
Yeah. I'm interested to see what you guys think about it. And later on, I'm burying the lead here, but I'll let you know how I feel about it as we move along.
I would expect so, yeah. So thank you again, Frank. Frank Olson has been on the show several times in the past. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks to all of you out there as well for hanging out and listening to the show. Please rate and review Camp Kaiju wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Also, make sure to check out our website and Patreon. Vincent, do you want to talk a little bit more about those?
Sure. CampKaijuMovieReviews.com features past episodes of this podcast, links to other reviews of ours that Matt and I and potential guest reviewers are typing up weekly. And links to our Patreon. You can visit patreon.com/campkaiju for all sorts of bonus features, special series, and other kinds of perks. Our lowest tier is just $3 a month. And our highest is only $15 a month. All that money helps us support the show and give back to all you for your support. So thank you to you all, including Frank. You are a patron. And Chris and Kelly and Peggy and our anonymous patrons. And for you all, we have one very special gong to hit. Frank, are you ready and willing to hit the Gamera gong?
I am, and it's I know it's an audio medium, but you have to imagine that I'm swinging it like a mace above my head here.
Wow, that was worth like the six windups you gave it. It was like a cartoon Looney Tune windup. It was really impressive. Good job.
I hope I didn't break it.
We had some other great stuff coming up on Camp Kaiju as well. Later in April, we're going to be talking about The Valley of Gwangi, which I think is our first Ray Harryhausen movie that we're going to be talking about on the podcast.
Yeah, some dinosaurs and cowboys. Very excited to talk about that. Then after that, we're going to get back to Godzilla with Godzilla versus King Ghidorah from 1991. And then rounding out the rest of this first half of the year, Wolf.
Directed by Mike Nichols, I believe, and starring Jack Nicholson. I've heard mixed... Yeah, it is 94, you're right. Yeah, I'm excited. I've heard mixed things about it, but it sounds very interesting to me. A friend of mine described it as not so much a werewolf movie and more about the publishing industry, so I am intrigued.
And Gary Dantzu, former Camp Kaiju host, will be returning for both of those two films, Wolf and Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah. Then we're going to talk about the OG Blob from the 1950s. And then our final movie before Kaijuli is Porco Rosso. And Frank, are you still on to help us talk about that one?
Yeah, looking forward to it. Yeah, I saw that, I don't know, maybe 10 or so years ago and remembered really liking it. So it's been one I've been wanting to revisit anyway. So yeah, definitely excited to get into that one.
Me too. The whole Studio Ghibli is like a whole world unto itself. I'm going to enjoy doing my homework for Porco Rosso.
Yeah, I really love Miyazaki, but I've only seen, for the most part, I've only seen his latter day movies and not a lot of his earlier movies. So I'm excited to visit Porco Rosso for the first time.
Yeah.
All right. So Flesh for Frankenstein is the movie that we're talking about tonight from 1974, directed by Paul Morrissey. I've always been really fascinated to see it. I mean, it just sounds so sleazy and trashy and gory and like filled with sex and nudity and just like such a product of its time in the early 70s. And like, you know, the idea of like taking that approach with such a classic of literature, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which this movie sort of bastardizes quite a bit, I think you could say. Despite this movie's many flaws, I still think it's going to be pretty fascinating to talk about. So I'll turn it over to Frank. What was your experience with this film and just kind of this whole world of films around this time?
I had seen Blood for Dracula. To be honest, remember that one being kind of boring. You know, that one was filmed, I think, like immediately after Flesh for Frankenstein and done as kind of like a, you know, he convinced the studio to finance both of them together, basically. So it has a lot of the same cast and crew and everything. But honestly, when you asked me to, you know, come on to do this one, I was willing to do it, but I wasn't super thrilled about the selection necessarily. But this one I think is a more interesting movie. Yeah. I don't really have a lot of knowledge of like what Paul Morrissey has done. I know, you know, he kind of comes from the like the Andy Warhol like that group of you know, just eccentrics that Andy Warhol hung out with, and you know, I know this movie is also had been released under the title Andy Warhol's Frankenstein, and somehow sometimes known as that, even though it seems like Warhol had basically nothing to do with it. You know, I know a little bit about like Andy Warhol's movies. I've seen a handful of them, and this doesn't really resemble them in any way. Pretty different than like his, you know, movie Empire, which is the like 8-hour continuous shot of the Empire State Building. So
maybe Flesh for Frankenstein is the empire of sleazy horror adaptations.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'll turn it over to Vincent now. Vincent, what is your experience with Flesh for Frankenstein, if any?
Well, I first heard about this film last fall, September. I was in one of my, you know, yearly Frankenstein deep dives. For long-time listeners, for you guys, you probably know Frankenstein, the 1933, no. Oh my God, what year did that movie come out? The original 32? One with Boris Karloff.
Or maybe 31. I think it's 31.
It is 31. Yeah.
31's right.
Oh, wow. I just lost my Frankenstein cred there. Okay. Yeah. So grew up with that movie. Love that movie. But for the longest time, the Universal series was really my only exposure to cinematic Frankensteins. And this movie definitely had me curious with the Andy Warhol name attached to it, which is the point of his whole producing there. And yeah, I didn't see it though until just last week. And it was both what I expected and also not what I expected. I can't wait to talk about it. I love the production history of this movie. I love the how it came into existence.
I would also like to add that you wrote your own adaptation of Frankenstein, a stage adaptation. So I don't think your Frankenstein credentials can ever be revoked. I think they will last you your entire life now. So
thank you. Thank you. I like to think, no, and that gets in my way too. Like I love the Frankenstein story so much. I don't mind seeing it bastardized, like whatever. I don't care. Like make something interesting. But sometimes it could also get in my way of like, no, that's not how Victor Frankenstein should act. And it's like, well, how should he act? That's the conversation. So
probably more interesting to see something that's not faithful to the original source material, you know, because it's well known at this point that, you know, what's the point of really making an ultra faithful version of it anyway? So,
right. So I do want to see all the other crazy sounding Frankensteins like Frankenhooker or Blackenstein or Frankenstein meets the space monster. There's just a whole slew of those types of Frankenstein adaptations that I'm here for, even if I don't like them. I'm here for them.
I hope we talk about many of them on this show in the future. Blackenstein was on the Criterion Channel recently, and I really, really wanted to watch it. And then I think it left at the end of March, so I did not get a chance. But
bummer.
It looks unique. I'll probably refer to Flesh for Frankenstein as unique numerous times because, like, that avoids me saying good or bad, which, like, you know, so it's a good evasion in that way.
Right.
Well, if you guys are ready, we can jump into a brief plot synopsis.
Let's do it. This gory, campy, sex-filled adaptation, in name only, of Mary Shelley's novel features a more sadistic version of Baron Frankenstein than you've ever seen before. He's married to his sister and even has two kids with her, so right off the bat, the movie is chock-full of incest. The Baron and his assistant, Otto, attempt to reanimate two beings, a male and a female, using dead tissue from corpses. Baron's ultimate goal is to create a master Serbian race descending from himself. He also achieves sexual gratification from the female monster, fondling and opening her surgical wounds and doing unthinkable things with her innards.
Disappointed with the lack of sexual libido in his male creation, the Baron and Otto find a handsome farmhand named Sasha as he's leaving a brothel and decapitate him, hoping to plant his head onto the monster's body. The plot thickens when Sasha's friend, Nicholas, is hired by the Baron's wife-slash-sister, Katrin, as a manservant, and to provide her with sexual favors. It all leads to a violent climax filled with disembowelment, death by lovemaking, and an impalement that must have really been something in the film's original 3D release.
Yeah, and I actually didn't realize it was released as a 3D movie. Something like the end impalement totally makes sense now why it was shot that way. But at the same time, the way it's framed, regardless of the 3D nature, I was like, that's a dynamic shot.
I really enjoy that shot too. There's also the moment pretty early on when the Baron and Otto are first sort of like handling a bunch of guts, and like the Baron is like holding all the entrails like directly out to the camera pretty much. Like I also didn't realize till after I saw it that it was released in some areas in 3D, but only some. In other places it was released in 2D. There were a lot of different versions of this movie that were released. It's kind of like, you know, all the sort of horror 3D movies like Friday the 13th 3D and Jaws 3D and stuff, where like there are so many, or there are some gratuitous moments where like, you know, viscera pops out of the screen to like take advantage of that 3D technology. And it's, yeah, it can be kind of fun in this movie at times.
The 3D element of it, and, you know, watching in you know, not 3D, is not nearly as distracting as it is in a lot of other movies like this. There's not, like, the cheesy stuff where someone's, like, you know, got, like, the ping pong paddle that they're, like, shaking directly at the screen, or any, like, real obvious stuff like that. Like, you know, like you were saying, kind of impalement shot toward the end is just kind of a cool-looking shot, even in 2D anyway.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I do love the end of this movie, just like how many people die like right in a row and their bodies are literally piled right on top of each other. I can only assume that's intentionally humorous because I found it hilarious. The film was directed by Paul Morrissey, pretty interesting figure in himself. It was part of Andy Warhol's factory for quite a long time. He worked with Warhol, co-directed with him on several films. Chelsea Girls might be one of the most famous films that he directed. I think he co-directed that one with Warhol, however. Morrissey also directed The Velvet Underground and Nico, A Symphony of Sound in 1966, and a movie called Flesh from 1968, which also stars Joe D'Alessandro. We'll talk about him in just a couple moments here. Morrissey also directed the first film featuring a transgender actress. Her name was Holly Woodlawn, and the film was called Trash from 1970. That film also starred D'Alessandro. So, you know, Morrissey seems to be kind of like a countercultural, forward-thinking, somewhat, you know, pushing the boundaries of film form a little bit. However, at the same time, he was a self-avowed right-winger. He called himself very conservative. He served in the U.S. Army. He publicly protested against immorality and anti-Catholicism. That kind of, you know, anti-immorality strain goes back to his first short, All Aboard the Dreamland Choo Choo, which sounds like a very disturbing and abrasive movie, and it's kind of a scathing indictment of hippie culture and just how, like, hippies can't take gratification in anything, and, like, even the most extreme sex and violence fails to excite them. So, just a lot of contradictions here. The fact that Morrissey made this movie and has, you know, like, worked with Warhol so much, who was such a, you know, avant-garde leftist figure, even though Morrissey apparently was not, although that's obviously open to discussion. The film has Andy Warhol's name attached to it, but he didn't really have very much to do with the making of the film. He reportedly visited the set once during production and then once again during the editing process. So that was really a case where his name was attached to it in a way to generate publicity and get more people to see the movie.
Well, just a little bit about him. He was an American visual artist and was really at his height in the 60s counterculture, but he started his career in the 50s and all the way up until his death in 1987. His works generally explore the relationship between artists and their expression, advertising, and celebrity culture. So you see those things in some of his most famous works, like the Campbell Soup cans and the Marilyn Diptych silk print. So he worked a lot in silk screens, as well as painting, photography, film, and experimental films like Empire, which keeps coming back. So that's Andy Warhol in a soup can for you.
Despite Warhol's relatively limited involvement in the film, it still seems like a pretty good example of Warhol's, you know, postmodernism. He's like one of the most like emblematic postmodern artists of all time, and like the Flesh for Frankenstein still definitely seems like a movie which, like, in its kind of like crude aesthetic and its sort of extremely self-aware approach to the material, still seems identifiably like it's coming from Warhol's factory. I think
you had second unit director Antonio Margheriti, who shot some of the special effects scenes. Margheriti was actually credited as the director in some of the Italian prints so that they could get tax breaks from the Italian government.
We also have, the film also has music by Claudio Gizzi. Surprisingly very somber score, I think. At times, this movie kind of plays like a parody of a European art movie, in my opinion, and I think the music goes a long way in suggesting that.
Cinematography by Luigi Cuvi, who had an accomplished career working on films such as Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion by Elio Petri and Avanti, I've heard of that one, by Billy Wilder, Dario Argento's Deep Red, and many others.
And the special effects were by Carlo Rambaldi, who worked with Mario Bava, Federico Fellini, Pier Paolo Pasolini, and Dario Argento. So like all of the big names of Italian cinema from that time. He did special effects work on other things as well, like Planet of the Vampires, Deep Red, which I just saw recently, the 1976 remake of King Kong, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Possession, Alien, E.T., The Extraterrestrial, the original Dune. So,
wow,
a bit of a big shot in the special effects world there.
Yeah, and this is one of his earliest special effects productions where he was kind of the head of the special effects for the film. And they're definitely bare bones. They seem very cheap at times, but sometimes they're pretty well done. They're pretty stylish and visceral, I think. There's a decapitation scene, which I definitely will be talking about later. So moving on to the cast of the film a little bit, Udo Kier, the legendary Udo Kier as Baron Frankenstein. He's maybe one of the main reasons I think this movie has such a cult status, because every single one of his line readings is so over the top and hammy and ridiculous and amazing. He was an openly gay actor who, all throughout his career, he was very open about his homosexuality. He's appeared in over 220 movies throughout his career. He's collaborated with Lars von Trier on almost all of von Trier's movies since 1987's Epidemic. Mm. He's also in Dario Argento's Suspiria, Fassbender's Lily Marleen, Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho, not to mention Hollywood blockbusters like Ace Ventura Pet Detective, Barb Wire, Blade, and Armageddon. Just one of the weirdest filmographies you can possibly find.
I know him best from Ace Ventura Pet Detective. I had no idea. But those eyes, he's very striking eyes that...
I was going to say, I always think of him as being sort of like, Christopher Walken, if Christopher Walken was German and like... not a very good actor, basically. he has that same kind of just like general like weirdness where he just like looks like he, you know, does not belong on this planet, basically.
And he just has that, the voice and the accent, where like you could listen to him read from the phone book for hours and I would be totally entertained, you know.
You've also got Joe D'Alessandro as Nicholas, the handsome stable boy. Morrissey had directed D'Alessandro in Trash, and which predate the sexual frankness and the dark humor of Flesh for Frankenstein. D'Alessandro became a sex symbol for the gay subculture in the 60s and 70s and is bisexual in real life. He had a troubled childhood, running away from his foster family numerous times and stealing cars and joining gangs in New York City. And he started modeling nude at 16 years old before meeting Warhol and Morrissey.
Yeah, and he plays a lot with, no pun intended, Monique Van Voren, who plays Katrin, Frankenstein's wife and sister. She was a Belgian actress, musician, and writer. And Sardon Zelenovac as Sasha, ironically the only Serbian in the cast, even though Frankenstein is supposed to be Serbian in this movie and constantly comments on Serbs being the, quote, superior race.
That whole Serbian thing really threw me off in this movie. Like, the first time Frankenstein mentions like the Serbian master race and like the superiority of Serbian noses or whatever, I'm like, is he saying Serbian? Like, like Udo Kier is clearly German, and he's got that Teutonic accent, and it seems like they're, you know, trying to sort of make him, you know, stand in for Nazi scientists and stuff. Like, I don't quite get the Serbian thing in the movie, but it is something they bring up frequently.
The way that he always says Nazum to talk about the Serbian nose, I think is really funny and almost kind of like cute in a way. Like the character is not cute at all. He's very, very disturbing and sadistic, but like his obsession with the Nazum, I find very funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, getting into the backstory, the production of the film a little bit. According to Paul Morrissey, it was Roman Polanski who originally pitched to him the idea of making a 3D version of Frankenstein. Who knows if that's true or not? It's Morrissey's own kind of, you know, tall tale, I guess.
Yeah. Like we said, Morrissey was part of what was called the factory. So this was the head, the headquarters of Andy Warhol. It was a literal factory where he employed people to produce his silk prints of his art. Of course, its reputation is beyond just that. It was like a legendary hangout for Warhol and his closest friends and colleagues and artists. And people like Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, Grace Jones, William S. Burroughs, just to name a very, very small number of really pop culture icons of the late 60s and 70s congregated there. There's a lot of drugs, there's a lot of sex, a lot of rock and roll, but it produced a lot of inspired art, I would say, including Flesh for Frankenstein, which I don't love. But I will say it is inspired. Like there was some imagination going on in here.
Yeah, definitely. Like the factory had like a lot of clout, I guess you could say, among like underground circles by this time, by 1974. So it's not hard to imagine why, you know, Morrissey would be invited to Italy by executive producers Carlo Ponti and Andrew Brownsburg. You know, Morrissey again had made a handful of movies, and you know, his films with D'Alessandro especially had some, you know, a pretty big following in like the underground gay communities, especially in New York. When the production went to Italy at the invitation of Ponti and Brownsburg, only Flesh for Frankenstein was originally supposed to be shot, but Morrissey convinced the executive producers to also fund the companion piece, Blood for Dracula. So that's why the two films were essentially shot back to back. I actually read earlier today that they finished shooting Flesh for Frankenstein, took a break for lunch, and then started shooting Blood for Dracula in the afternoon, which I think is kind of awesome. And maybe an example of the level of preparation they had going into these movies.
Flesh for Frankenstein was all improvised, right?
Well, actually, no. Interestingly enough, Morrissey wanted it to be improvised, but because a lot of the cast was speaking English, which was not their first language, like that wasn't really a possibility. So Morrissey would kind of write dialogue every day, like on a day by day basis. He would scribble out the dialogue and give it to the actors to shoot later that day. So not exactly improvised, but certainly kind of like written on the fly. And I think it's pretty easy to get that sense from the movie, you know?
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a lot of the actors, including, you know, some of the main characters are reading the dialogue phonetically as they go.
I just really love the line readings in this movie, which make already ridiculous dialogue even more absurd. So I'm okay with it. You know, I think for me, it works well in its own way. So production of the film took place at Cinecittà Studios, a legendary film studio in Rome, 99-acre studio lot. Films such as Ben-Hur, La Dolce Vita, Cleopatra, Gangs of New York, many, many others were shot. This is just a legendary studio in film history.
There's a real, like, distinct Cinecittà look to, like, the sets and stuff. Like, you know, it's mainly, like, a sleazy exploitation movie, but every once in a while you get these just, like, stray shots where, like, am I all of a sudden, like, watching a Fellini movie or something? Like, especially, like, the doctor's lab set, and also there's one just kind of like randomly beautiful shot of them around the dinner table at one point. You really get just like the benefit of the Cinecittà Studios just like making things look good, even when the filmmakers don't always seem totally competent, you know?
It does, like sometimes it even made me think like maybe the filmmakers do know what they're doing, but like are intentionally going for a kind of like grade Z aesthetic, you know? And I know that's like a very generous way of looking at it, but you're right that there are some moments where the sets and the cinematography, and like I said before, I think the music is pretty effective at times too. Like there are a couple seconds here and there where I'm like, oh, they actually do know what they're doing, and then like a moment later you're like, maybe not. That's
it weirdly kind of reminded me of Caligula, which I believe was also shot in Italy. I don't know if they did it at Cinecittà or not. I mean, this is a much more entertaining movie than Caligula. I think Caligula is pretty terrible, but that's another like super sleazy movie that has, you know, just these moments where you're like, man, what this elaborate set is really beautiful, and it's like so weird that it's in this sleazy, cheesy movie.
The film was released in the United States and West Germany as Andy Warhol's Frankenstein. The original Italian version, I find interesting, had less explicit sex scenes but more gruesome violence. It was initially banned by Italian censors before it was recut. It was released with an X rating, at least in the United States, which actually wasn't all too uncommon at the time in the early 70s. Midnight Cowboy was released in the late 60s as an X-rated movie. So today we hear X-rating and it's very pornographic, but at the time, not necessarily the case. The movie was a success, actually. So taking all that into account, the estimated budget was $300,000. And in 1974, the LA Times reported that the film had grossed $7 million. BanditsEmporium.com is the official t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju. Check out BanditsEmporium.com or hit the link in our bio to check out their selection of monster-inspired tees. Part of the proceeds goes to supporting this very show. So visit BanditsEmporium.com. Whatever your style, they have you covered. As they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, Matt, what's the line?
As Camp Kaiju says, to know death, Otto, you have to fuck life in the gallbladder. Was that good?
Brilliant. One take.
And that's the end of your sponsorship deal.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to force Bandits Emporium to change their slogan to that line of dialogue. One of the most interesting things about this movie, I think, is it's camp value. And, we talk about camp a lot on Camp Kaiju. We have our the good, the bad, and the campy section. For the most part, we've had a pretty loose definition of camp, kind of just anything that's funny and ridiculous, we throw into that category. And I love that. I think that's the way, the way it should be on Camp Kaiju. But there is a more true and exact definition of camp, especially as offered by Susan Sontag in her famous essay, which I think is called Notes on Camp. And Flesh for Frankenstein, like, so utterly fits this description. So Sontag wrote, camp is a sensibility that revels in artifice, stylization, theatricalization, irony, playfulness, and exaggeration rather than content. It is seen as connected to postmodernism and queerness. Sontag wrote, by exaggerating sexual characteristics and personality mannerisms, queer inflected camp could be said to contend that all behavior is really performative. And finally, Sontag wrote, camp sees everything in quotation marks. Many examples of camp are things which, from a serious point of view, are either bad art or kitsch. That last line in particular, I think, just so exactly applies to Flesh for Frankenstein. So in my opinion, this might be the most purely campy movie we've talked about so far in Camp Kaiju, which I that doesn't make it good or bad. I just think it's like it's such a fascinating reflection of like this. It's not even really a subgenre, like kind of a category or like an artistic mode that is so hard to describe. But I feel like this movie fits it to a T.
It's so funny we're talking about camp on Camp Kaiju. We're getting a little meta, but these words are really great in highlighting the specific identity of camp, because it's, for me, it's kind of like you just know it when you see it. In this movie, I don't know, maybe it was so campy, it just like it went over my head a little bit. Like, I understand, like, it was larger than life, but my initial reading was, this is just bad art, which is Sontag's whole point.
Yeah, and I think, like, in a way, it's kind of Warhol's point at times, too. Like, when he does the paintings of the Campbell soup cans, for example, or the Marilyn diptych, which is, Marilyn Monroe kind of repeated several times, twice, I guess. Yeah, like, I feel like part of his postmodern mission as well is to say, like, the boundaries between like highbrow and lowbrow and like classic art and postmodern art are kind of irrelevant, like really trying to break down all those boundaries, I think, like how intentionally Flesh for Frankenstein is trying to do that is another question. Maybe it's not really trying to do that and it's just a poorly made movie. But I think the end result is it's campy as hell and like just interesting to think about, like, what it's trying to do, if anything. Like, is it just a poorly made movie, or is it trying to take this, like, enshrined classic of Gothic literature and make it as sleazy and trashy as possible, you know? Again, a generous reading, but
But yeah,
possible.
but I think the choosing of such an established classic in which to bastardize seems intentional. Otherwise, they could have just made an original sexploitation film, which sure, but the whole point of camp or postmodernist approach to established classics is to turn it on its head.
You know, the political viewpoint of the movie and talking about the viewpoint of the movie, which, you know, is also a little bit hard to figure out what's intentional and what's not, and what the point of view is, if there is a consistent point of view here. Because some people see it as like a denunciation of the upper class as represented by, you know, kind of these despicable wealthy characters who live in this castle and exploit and demean their peasants and their servants around them, and you know, even literally take their lives for their experiments in some cases. And some other people also see it as like a conservative mockery of the counterculture, with, you know, people who are so disassociated that no kinds of sex or violence can satisfy. But whether or not the movie actually has anything politically coherent to say is debatable, I think.
I would agree with that. Like, it seems to kind of throw everything at the wall to like try to provoke people, but probably doesn't have a clear viewpoint of its own.
I feel like I've seen movies that are just as exploitative, but the focus is sharper, where any sort of messaging is loud and clear, while also being campy and gory and sexy and blah, blah, blah. And this movie for me just wasn't focused enough in the madness. Like, you know what I mean?
Definitely a long history of, you know, horror movies and other kinds of exploitation movies that do have, you know, a clear political point of view and are, you know, sometimes either smuggling that message in or just making it very overt. But yeah, this one definitely is not as clear about what its meaning is. And, you know, like we're saying, it's not even clear if there is really an intent there.
Yeah, exactly. I, you know, reading about some of Morrissey's early short films, which I haven't seen myself, but like reading descriptions of them, like his first short, All Aboard the Dreamland Choo Choo, is about somebody who is taking drugs. I think it's heroin, although I could be wrong about that. And then they kind of just like look very vacant and passive and then like stab themselves in the leg with a knife at the end of the short film. That film has been read as like, again, a mockery of hippies who just like, no matter how many drugs they take or what they do, they just can never sort of like experience a thrill or like passion from life. It would be easy enough to like extend that theme to Flesh for Frankenstein, but then we have the Baron and Katrin sort of explicitly saying like we're so much better than all these peasants, they're worthless, they're just like literally flesh for us to use. So yeah, that's just a like I totally agree that like what it's trying to say is all over the place, and I don't think you can really get one clear interpretation out of it.
Have you guys, I don't know, have you guys been to the MoMA in New York City, Museum of Modern Art?
I haven't.
Not for a long time. I was there like 20 years ago, I think.
Well, that's just like the best example of a modern art museum I can think of, but any type of modern art, like when I was a kid, I was like, this is just a waste of time. But now as an adult, like I do love it. I do love sitting in a dark room in a museum and watching a weird avant-garde film for 8 minutes, where at the end someone just stabs themselves in the leg. Translated to a feature-length film, it kind of runs out of steam for me with like Flesh. If Flesh for Frankenstein is like an art house piece, great. But for a feature-length film, again, it ran out of steam for me.
Yeah, and there are very tedious long stretches of this movie where like just yeah, like for you know, for all the mayhem and carnage and ridiculousness that happens in other parts in the movie, like there are other scenes and stretches that are just pretty boring to be honest. So it's like yeah, it kind of overindulges that for sure.
So one theme that becomes very apparent from the beginning is like the quest for a superhuman race of men, which echoes the fascism of Nazi Germany. And for me, yes, the story is always about Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein creating the perfect human, whatever that is. But in this adaptation, it's very explicit. I think master race is used, like even that language, which to me runs counter to Shelley's warning of supermen run amok. In this one, the Baron is, that's what he is seeking. He wants a master race of Serbians. But in the early 1970s, there was no way that Italian and other European audiences wouldn't have connected that anyways with World War II and the Holocaust and Hitler's ambitions. One of Frankenstein's speeches is even accompanied by a piece from a Wagner opera. So this all seems to be very intentional. Yeah, only like 30 years after the end of the war, the shadow looms large over this film in ways that, again, I don't know what is trying to be said by Morrissey. Are we espousing the eugenics here in the film? Or is it a criticism of the eugenics in the film? Unclear for me.
I think he's definitely supposed to be, like, you know, a villainous guy. But yeah, making it, you know... The fact that you could watch it and be unclear about whether the Nazi is supposed to be a good guy or not is a good indication of how kind of muddled this movie is, though.
Like, you know, the question for me is the connection is so obvious to the recent history in Europe at the time this movie came out of fascism and xenophobia and genocide and eugenics and all that. But like, what is it trying to say about that? Like, if it's kind of just like, again, trying to be provocative and, you know, make these allusions to the Holocaust, this movie is so like schlocky and sleazy that it's not really kind of intentional or sophisticated enough to like make those connections meaningful, you know? So like, it's a provocative connection, but at the end of the movie, I'm like, all right, but what's the point? What are you saying about that? You know?
Right. And this is a great movie, great piece of art to talk about. Like, does art have to have meaning? Does it have to have a clear thematic message, or can it just be? And my personal taste is that it stands the test of time more if there is a clear message. But if not, I mean, that's okay too.
It's definitely a valid point that like art maybe doesn't necessarily have to have like a theme or a thing to say or whatever. But I think if you're making a connection to the Holocaust, like there should be a pretty good reason for it, is my thinking, you know, like so that, you know, even though I do like and appreciate this movie in many ways, like all of that stuff just seems excessive to me. And I know the movie is trying to be tasteless, but that's like a level of tastelessness that is hard to get over, I think, at times. So I wanted to bring up the kind of circularity of the plot, which I think is kind of interesting. The film begins with Frankenstein's human children, which he has had with his sister. They're kind of like dissecting a stuffed animal with these scalpels. And then at the end of the film, those same kids are like, they have their scalpels again. They seem like they're like about ready to start their dissection, but it's like a human body that's like there for them to do experiments upon, which seems to be a theme of like the sins committed by the father will be, you know, perpetrated by the children and like continue on for like the next generations. So if there is a theme of like all these points about fascism and the Holocaust and stuff, maybe the movie is trying to say, probably giving the movie too much credit, but maybe it's trying to say that like future generations can and probably will commit the same atrocities that our forefathers have done, you know? That's all I can get out of it.
I can buy that. I think the inclusion of the children is probably the closest thing to an obvious through line of messaging, of themes. So I'm glad that it had that button, that it did bring it full circle.
Flesh for Frankenstein, and I think a lot of other exploitation movies from this period, really lives on the border between trash and art. And as we already talked about, that's kind of like the postmodern tactic of like erasing those borders between highbrow and lowbrow. But I just think it's really interesting because you have these great 60s European modernist movies by like Antonioni, Bergman, Fellini, like, you know, those kind of great directors are like very artful, purposeful directors. And I just think there's a fairly clear like lineage from those movies to movies like Flesh for Frankenstein. And I'm not trying to put them at the same quality level because that is absolutely not the case. But I think it's interesting to think about how like the themes of alienation and like human degradation and lack of connection, things like that, that some of those directors were trying to get at. It's almost like it rots and decays and becomes something like totally sleazy and disgusting by the 70s, when at the same time, like, censorship constraints were just like thrown out the window and you could put any kind of sex and violence and like atrocity into movies, you know? So even though I don't really like exploitation movies and many of them seem very like cruel and empty provocation kind of, I do think it's sort of interesting to think about like the connections between a movie like Flesh for Frankenstein and like, you know, something by Fellini or Antonioni or whatever. It reminds me of the fact that Last House on the Left by Wes Craven was a remake of The Virgin Spring by Ingmar Bergman. So I think, I to be honest, I haven't really like thought through the connections here all that much, but I think we can trace this sort of like sordid genealogy from those great movies to something like this kind of schlocky, sleazy trash or whatever, you know? And I think that's really interesting to think about.
That sounds like an essay just begging to be written, Matt.
We'll see if I ever have time to write that one. I don't know. And maybe there's nothing really there. It's very possible, but my mind was running, you know, just doing somersaults while I watched this movie thinking about that. The one thing that I'll add here, I guess I could put this in my bad category, but just like such an ugly film stock. I think even if like there are some like nice tracking shots and nice sets in this movie, but still I was like, wow, like I don't know what it was about film stocks that they used in the early 70s, but they just do not look very good, especially compared to like, you know, like the nice, beautiful, shadowy black and white, or like the brilliant Technicolor of like the 40s and 50s, you know, it had gotten pretty ugly generally by this point.
Think of all the like beautiful color movies, color cinematography movies from like the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And there aren't nearly as many of those in the 70s. It is just kind of a flatter, more like TV style look that things move into. I guess presumably maybe for budget reasons, but yeah, definitely not for the better.
I like a beautiful visual aesthetic, and I missed it quite a bit in this movie, I would say. Vincent, do you want to start us off with the good category?
The first thing I did note that I was like, I like this, is the score. I felt like whatever nonsense was happening on the screen, the music grounded it in a sincerity that I appreciated. Mostly, like, I love, you know, there's a pulsating pair of lungs in a couple shots. I thought that was really well done. And then finally, my favorite thing was just the set design of the lab. And there's like cut off limbs hanging out in a pile in one corner. There's like naked bodies overlaying in a mangled pile in another corner. And there's like Greco-Roman statues everywhere. I thought this is not like any other Frankenstein movie I've seen, and I love it.
Yeah, I think that early like tracking shot through the lab is pretty cool too. It has like sort of a weird elegance to it in a movie that otherwise is not very elegant.
Mm-hmm.
But where it's just, you know, they've got like a body up on like a gurney and they're moving it around. And then at the end, it kind of gets put in this heap of other bodies that have been hacked up and stuff, which, you know, it's really like macabre, but it has a sort of like weird beauty to it. Just the way the camera's gliding around the room. For me, with this movie, the good and the campy categories are kind of inseparable. I mean,
yeah.
I was mostly really entertained by the just some of the like terrible line readings. Like, they're really like amusingly terrible ones. I mean, there's one early on where Baron Frankenstein is explaining to his assistant Otto like a little bit about his plan to find parts for his male monster, because he's got, at that point, he's got the female one set, but he needs a male one to mate her with. And he's explaining how, you know, at some point in his past he's been to Bordello, and then Otto goes like, "Oh, Bordello, you Baron?" and then he's like, yes, me, or whatever. And then he's like, "Oh," and that one made me laugh. I recorded that one and sent it to my brother. There was another one later when they're actually at the brothel, or they're outside the brothel kind of waiting for the people to come out, and there's like two naked women that run out, and they see the one guy emerge, and Udo Kier says it's something to the effect of like, "Two women, one man, he must be very powerful."
I was like, oh my god, that sounds like a line from Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, for sure. For me, in the good category, in addition to all that stuff, and like just all the kind of like putting it in like its historical context of like camp and postmodernism and stuff like that, there are some moments that I think must be intentionally funny because it's just impossible that it wouldn't be intentional. For example, the part where the Baron's hand is cut off towards the end, and he like tries to reattach it just by like shoving it back on his stump, and that doesn't work, and then he throws his own hand at Nicholas. Like, that's so silly. Like, that has to be intentionally funny. And then the part where Katrin and Nicholas are having sex, or they're not quite having sex, but she's like trying to, get him to do so. And the way that she does so is by like sucking his armpit, like very loudly and for a very long time. One last thing that I want to mention for the good category, there are just like entrails that are just like bright red crimson, just like dripping with like viscera, and for a horror lover, it is very visceral. It's, to use the actual origin of that word, it's very visceral, it's really intense, it's sort of, it looks pretty cool at times. And like the best example is Sasha's decapitation with the garden shears, where bright red blood just starts like spraying out like a geyser. And then we see this headless body kind of just like stumble around and blood is still flying everywhere. Obviously, it's very disgusting, over the top, tasteless. But I mean, if you love horror, that's probably what you're watching this movie for. And I think that scene is pretty well done.
The high point of the film, for sure.
On that note, moving on to the bad. I can start real quick. I feel like I have less in the bad category than you guys. We've already talked about a lot of the bad stuff, the kind of boring stretches. It doesn't really look all that great. And I would just say that for a movie like this, it's hard, the fact that you can't really take it seriously means that it's not like emotionally powerful, or it probably won't really stay with me all that much. So, a movie like this can never really be a masterpiece because it seems like it's not even taking itself seriously.
Yeah, I found the performances way not just over the top, but just like bad. Like some of the supporting actors, whoever it is who has a he didn't even try to cover up his New York accent. He's just, hey, I'm in New York, and but now I'm in Europe. That rubbed me the wrong way. The rape of the female body, the or necrophilia, it was like really slow and drawn out. And Baron is grunting and orgasming, and my stomach's getting a little queasy thinking about it right now, which maybe is the point, but not for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, some of the campy gore, like I was just talking about, is entertainingly over the top, but that scene is just really gross and disturbing at a level that, like, again, if you're gonna make something so repugnant, like, I think you should have a pretty good reason for it. Like, the movie Salò by Pasolini, which I have to admit I've never actually seen, but that's just a movie about like the lowest depths of like human behavior, and so it, like, if you're making a comment like that, I feel like maybe you can like get away with depictions like that, but not so much in Flesh for Frankenstein. That scene is like extremely disturbing for no real discernible reason,
Because it didn't even come off as campy or over the top. It was like real. There was no sense of absurdity to it. And I think that's what made it uncomfortable.
It's not really even like disturbing or anything either. It's just kind of like it's just disgusting, basically. It's kind of like partially, the line of dialogue at the end of that scene like partially kind of justifies it because it's
I was gonna say, you kind of have to feel for the actress, right? Who's like, naked the whole time. Like, she's strapped down to this table and it looks extremely uncomfortable. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure she was a willing actor, a paid actor, obviously, but like, it must have been like pretty, difficult and uncomfortable to be in that scene for her, I would think.
On the subject of the sex scenes too, I've like one kind of nitpick. They do the thing in this movie a few times where you see like the male and female creatures kind of like propped up on stuff, so that they're kind of in a standing position, and they're naked except for like cloth over their like these cloth patches over their genitalia. And I always think it's stuff like that. Like, okay, if this was like somehow a real situation, which obviously this is totally ridiculous, but if it was somehow a real situation, like they wouldn't have those cloth pieces on. And I'm not saying like the actor should have been forced to do full frontal nudity, but like I don't know, maybe just like shoot it in a different way then, where you're just only showing them waist up or something instead of just, you know, doing these things that draw attention.
Right. Because I don't think Baron or Otto have scruples about that. That was just for the audiences.
Not a big deal, but just one of those things that was like sort of annoying me.
Yeah. And makes an already like very implausible movie even more like impossible to believe, you know?
For the most part, I think the worst thing about this movie is kind of what we've brought up a few times, where it just doesn't seem to have any particular consistent point of view, or, you know, point that it's trying to get across, or basic viewpoint. It seems overall pretty random, and while it has, you know, a lot of entertaining individual moments, it doesn't really hold together for me as a full movie.
Definitely all valid criticisms for sure. Yeah. We've already talked a lot about the campy aspects of the film. Do we want to say any more of the ridiculous lines of dialogue just to have a little bit of fun here at the end?
Well, I have one thing I want to add to my campy.
Okay.
A couple things. They involve Otto. So Otto, after cutting off what's his name's head, he like beats the body with a stick or something. Thought that was very funny. And also at the end, when they put the male and the female now living creatures together, both the Baron and Otto are like peeking down at the male's genitalia to see if there's any sort of arousal. It's just like Otto is just doing this as a choice by the by, and I was like, this is cracking me up. This is so funny.
That whole scene, I think it's the same scene where Ulukir keeps going like, kiss, kiss,
yes,
kiss.
Kiss him.
pretty entertaining moment.
So another one of my favorite examples is during that same scene you were talking about, Frank, where Frankenstein is talking about how he was convinced to go to the bordello by his school friends or whatever. And he's talking about the prostitutes, and Frankenstein says, with their filthy movements and dirty talk, it was terrible. I really love that line a lot. And then later on when he says to Katrin, his wife slash sister, shut up, you sex maniac. I really love that line as well. There are probably dozens more lines that we could say right now, but those are my favorites. All right, we have four ratings here on Camp Kaiju. Our highest rating is, it is a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Our second rating is, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Our third rating is, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it doesn't stand the test of time. And our worst rating, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time. You know, I do kind of admire this movie in some ways. Like, it is really trashy, really sleazy. It has a lot of flaws for sure. But I think it's really interesting to think about. I think it's like a pretty interesting reflection of like where cinema was at in the early 70s. I think like placing it in the context of like, camp and postmodernism and like low art versus high art. And then kind of connecting that to Warhol's Factory a little bit. All that stuff is pretty fascinating to me, but the movie itself is not like, not especially well made and doesn't really seem to have anything to say. So I want to be a little provocative. Maybe I'm inspired by the movie. So I'm going to say there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. I can see myself watching this movie again in the future and just being really like amused and like bewildered by it all over again.
I love it. I disagree, but I get what you mean. If I'm being generous, I would say that this film is historically significant. I can give it that, but I gotta be honest with you guys, first time I watched it, I couldn't finish. I fell asleep. The second time I tried to watch it, I also fell asleep by the end. The third time I was just skipping around the last 10 minutes because I was like, this movie has just completely devolved into mayhem and I don't understand what's happening. I don't care what's happening. Nothing interests me anymore. And it started off strong. So it's a shame that by the end, I was like, I don't care. So I don't think it stands the test of time. Historically, sure.
Yeah, I would put it in that same category as you, Vincent. I disagree slightly because I don't know that this movie is that historically significant. I don't know. I do think it's somewhat fun though. I mean a lot of the like terrible dialogue delivered by terrible actors like we've talked about is kind of fun. And there are some actual, like, you know, like we've talked about, some cool sets, you know, a few cool camera movements and things like that. But yeah, I don't think it's a very good movie overall. I'd say it's not one I'd probably go back to again.
Honestly, I was kind of hoping that we would have like a pretty wide range of reactions because it's a very polarizing movie. So certainly understand your criticisms. I think they're all extremely valid. I'll stick up for this movie a little bit more.
I get tired of liking everything I see, so it's good to really dislike something.
Yeah. If nothing else, I'm proud of bringing a movie to the podcast that you actively hated. I feel like I achieved something. There's always Porco Rosso. I'm excited to talk about that in a couple months. So. On that note, thank you again, Frank. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. This was a great conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. And thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com, Instagram, or Patreon.com/CampKaiju for more monster movie content. We can't thank you enough. And before I forget, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com. Hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. And as Camp Kaiju says, thanks again, friends. Until next time,
stay campy.
To know death, Otto, you have to fuck life in the gallbladder.